United States versus Foreman.
Jonathan Sondland on behalf of the appellant Conrad Foreman. I'll be addressing both issues raised on appeal in this case, and I'll reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. I'll start off with the first issue, the substitution of counsel issue, and I will use the government's 28J letter addressing the Franklin case as my jumping off point on this. Franklin is a case that fits neatly in with the cases that have been briefed already, in particular the Smith case, not a lot of a Gonzalez case. Read together, these cases establish essentially a preference upon a motion for substitution of counsel for on-the-record targeted inquiries regarding not just whether there might be ineffective representation happening, but more importantly, what has happened to the nature of the relationship between the attorney and the client. Because we're in such a breakdown in the relationship that effective representation is no longer possible. Franklin does not change that inquiry and fits in with what we see from Adelazo Gonzalez and Smith. Adelazo Gonzalez, the case when this court reversed and said there should have been a substitution of counsel, the court said targeted questions are essential, and not just targeted questions regarding the nature of particular complaints the defendant may have about the effectiveness or tactical decisions being made by the attorney, but targeted questions about communication and about has there been a breakdown in the relationship between the attorney and the client. Smith and Franklin together establish that there still is a preference for this sort of targeted questioning.
But what do you mean by preference? I'm not quite sure what you're driving at by using preference. There's no ironclad rule that there shall be questions such as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Absolutely. In Smith, there were no questions. There was not even, and I should say in Smith, there were two substitution of counsel motions reviewed. I'm talking about the second one, the post-trial motion. There was no inquiry on the record made by the judge in this court.
I'll tell you what tantalizes me about this case, and that is that when you tell us that there was a complete breakdown of communications between the client and counsel, and there clearly was trouble, and that was approved by the trial court. But then later on, your client pleaded guilty, and when he did, in writing, he signed a document. You know what the document said. I'm satisfied with my lawyer's representation. And then he said the same thing orally when the plea went down. And I'm tantalized by that. I mean, you're telling me there was a complete breakdown, and then all of a sudden you have your client saying, I'm happy with my lawyer and entering the plea, and the judge going through the whole business and deciding that it's completely voluntary. The judge told your client, you don't have to plead guilty if you don't want to. And so what do we do with all of that? That's a bit of a curveball in this case that we don't usually confront.
I think that's right.
Why do we even have jurisdiction to review this?
Your jurisdiction, because there's no...
I mean, this is sort of follow up from Scott's question. Why isn't whatever happened, whatever unhappiness may have happened there, washed out by the guilty plea? He pleaded, he entered an unconditional, unchallenged guilty plea, a voluntary guilty plea. Why doesn't everything that happened before get washed out, depriving us of even the jurisdiction to look at it?
Because the inquiry that the court makes in reviewing denial of substitution of counsel conflates essentially with the finding of whether that guilty plea was properly entered. You have a defendant.
But you haven't challenged the voluntariness of the guilty plea.
No.
So if you haven't challenged the voluntariness of the guilty plea is voluntary. It's established fact, a law of the case. Bam. So isn't this like a suppression motion? You file a suppression motion. You lose a suppression motion. You don't preserve it for appeal. Your client takes a plea, doesn't preserve it. It's not a conditional plea. We can't look behind that. I'm not quite sure why the curtain has fallen. How do we get behind it?
Substitution of counsel, I think, is qualitatively different than, say, suppression motion.
What case goes that suggests that that's the case? They're both constitutional.
Right. There's no case that I found that directly addressing the question.
The principle is that once you enter a voluntary plea, then wipes out all existing constitutional complaints.
The one case I would rely on is the Lozada Gonzalez case. That is the case exactly in this posture. The court didn't discuss that question. I don't know whether the government didn't raise it or not.
So it's not a holding.
So it's not a holding. But this court does, if it is a jurisdictional question, has an obligation to sua sponte, determine whether it has jurisdiction. Presumably that was done in that case. It's not, obviously not as binding and controlling as it would be had the court laid out its analysis and said, we have jurisdiction. But going back to this question,
sort of binding, it's like going to war. There's not a little bit about it. It's either binding authority or it's not. If you read that case as holding we have jurisdiction, then we can look at it as how to reconcile with all of our other cases that say once you enter a voluntary guilty plea, you can challenge the voluntariness. You can get the review of any issues that you preserve. You could call it a conditional plea, as you know. But everything else is wiped out.
I urge the court to take a look at Adelazo and Gonzalez. It's a case in this posture, the court says, it does not address the question, but would have had to address the merits of it.
If it was aware of the jurisdiction question.
That's correct.
On another level, it seems to me that the advice which the lawyer gave was correct. Is that not right?
We're not, at this point, not taking any issue with the legal advice in terms of the questions of the guidelines calculations and the suppression of the wiretap or the wire that was worn.
Don't go back to where I was a few minutes ago. What do we do with the fact that in writing, if you brush it aside as boilerplate and formulaic, those are two interesting labels, but the facts still remain that your client in writing and orally said, I'm satisfied with my lawyer's representation.
Right. 3 days after his motion, 3 days over a weekend, including the weekend, after he had heard his motion, his motion was denied.
Doesn't that suggest that the district court was correct, that there was simply a scramble about whether this so-called wiretap evidence was admissible and how to calculate the guideline sentence? That this was a tactical thing? There really wasn't a breakdown in communications? There was just a difference in ideas about how the case ought to proceed?
Well, what happened on the day of the guilty plea was, first of all, not before the court, before the district court, when it was ruling on the motion for substitution of counsel. That happened later. And
that's why
it's not part of the landscape.
I know, but it's part of the entire landscape. You're hearing appeal saying, my client's got a raw deal down there, but here you've got the client saying, I'm happy with his lawyer. What do we do with that?
Well, are we
required to ignore that because it happened a couple days later? That's not a rhetorical question.
No, I forgot. That's the point I'm making. It's not on the record before the judge when the judge is making the ruling.
So anything that happens after the inquiry is out of bounds?
In reviewing the motion for substitution counsel, yes.
Do you have any cases or what principle would you rely on?
It's essentially the principle that you're reviewing a decision of the court. You would be looking at something that the district court didn't have before it when it was making that decision.
Counsel, do you want to talk about the restitution issue?
I'll briefly make the point that this is the language of the statute is very plain. It tells the district court, you've got multiple defendants, you've got a choice. You're either going to make each defendant liable for payment for the full amount, or you apportion liability. The district court did both. It apportioned liability for DaCosta, and it ordered full joint and several liability for my client.
Why isn't that his portion?
Because the statute doesn't permit the judge to do that. The statute says, it gives a choice. You either apportion for all the defendants, or you make each defendant liable.
So the definition of apportion means it has to be less than the total amount.
That's correct. And the In fact, looking at the record in DaCosta's case, we have a sentencing transcript in the record, and it's at ER 73. Looking at it at DaCosta's sentencing hearing, that is actually what the judge was planning to do. She says, under the circumstances, the court feels it is appropriate, pursuant to Title 18, Section 664, Sub H, to apportion liability for the contribution to the victim's loss amongst those three defendants. My client wasn't at the hearing. His attorney wasn't at the hearing. The government, of course, was, and the district court was. But when it came time for imposition of the joint and several liability for my client, that information was not made part of the record, and that's where it stood. And he was denied the right to be present when those decisions were made at the DaCosta's proceedings. He was denied counsel at the DaCosta's proceedings. Granted, that's an unusual argument, but a decision was made at that hearing that would affect his rights, and he wasn't present for that.
Let me draw back to the first issue. Yeah. What are you asking us to do? What do you want us to do with your client's case?
At this point, the court can only remand it for a hearing for further inquiry on the adequacy for a decision on whether or not there was a breakdown in the relationship between attorney and client. There was no decision on that.
And if we were to remand it for a continuation of the hearing and whether there was a breakdown of communication, the trial court cannot consider the later developments that the client said, I'm happy with the lawyer's representation.
Well, I think the court has to consider what was happening on August 7th, I believe is the date, and what was...
And if the court should conclude in your favor that there was a breakdown, what happens then?
Then the guilty plea would be vacated.
And what happens then?
And he proceeds anew with new counsel.
To what?
Whatever that it's as if this court...
I mean, what's the end game? He was looking at 46 months and got 41. So you say he wants to try for 46 now?
He may go to trial. The government may offer him a new deal.
The government turned down the deal. You're not going to get a new deal. You know that.
We don't.
You get an upward departure. The PSR says he qualifies for an upward departure because his criminal history is underrepresented in the point total.
Well,
your client may be walking into a higher sentence.
He pled guilty with no plea.
Straight up.
Yeah. There was no protections, and there's no reason to think he'd be doing anything worse. And there is a presumption that a higher sentence would be vindictive in that situation.
But it might not be.
It might not. That's correct.
Is your client aware that he may get a worse sentence by going back and starting over?
He's aware.
Okay. We'll hear from the government.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. John Heeman for the United States. I'd like to start with the jurisdictional point. I think what the defense, the appellant, is asking this court to do is to set up a per se rule that when there is a motion for substitution of counsel, that anything that comes after that, including a guilty plea, is not necessarily voluntary. And what is the law is, and it is very clear, that a guilty plea breaks the chain. And anything that happens before it is waived except for a claim, which the defendant is not making, that he received ineffective assistance with respect to the guilty plea. The defendant is saying that's true except when I merely move to substitute counsel, because the motion then raises the issue of whether the court erroneously denies the motion. What is going to follow is the argument that everything that follows from an erroneous denial of a motion to substitute counsel is not, every decision that is made by the defendant is not knowing and intelligent, including, as in this case, the guilty plea.
Could he have entered a conditional plea of guilty and preserved this issue?
In the absence of a plea agreement, I'm not sure that he could have entered a conditional plea of guilty and preserved this issue. It certainly wasn't raised in the district court.
Counsel, isn't a claim of incompetence of counsel very close to a claim of incapacity to communicate effectively with counsel?
I think, Your Honor, if there had been a claim of incompetence of counsel, that would be something that it would be important to discuss. And I think
that's not my question.
Is a claim of incapacity of counsel and incompetence of counsel.
Incapacity of the client to communicate effectively with his counsel very much like a claim of incompetence of counsel?
I think that claim is consistent with incompetence of counsel, and that is what that claim is what would have triggered a obligation on the part of the district court to inquire as to the communication. If the defendant had walked into court and said, Your Honor, I've got this complaint that I want to raise with you, and he had written the letter that's in the excerpts of record that it actually lays out exactly what his complaint is. If he had said, Your Honor, I can't talk to my lawyer, like the defendant in Adelzo Gonzalez, or like the defendant in the Walker case. I simply can't talk to him. He doesn't understand me. I understand what he's talking about. Then the district court has to explore that particular complaint. When the defendant comes into court and says, as he did in this case, Your Honor, I disagree with my lawyer, and I don't think that he's doing what I think he should be doing, that obligates the district court to do something different, and something that's why this case is like the Franklin case. In Franklin, the client came in and said, I disagree with my lawyer. He's doing things that I don't think he should be doing. And so the district court explored the conflict. There's the three-part test that is recited in almost all the cases. One is the request for substitution timely. Two, did the court adequately inquire into the conflict? And three, did the inquiry reveal a total breakdown in communication? We're on number two in this case, the adequacy of the inquiry. And it doesn't say, none of the cases say, did the district court adequately inquire into the communications breakdown? Because that presupposes a communications breakdown. What the cases say is, did the district court adequately inquire into the conflict? And in this case, the record is absolutely clear that the district court did. Unlike the district court in the Smith case, unlike the district court in the Walker case, and unlike the district court in Adelzo Gonzalez, Judge Chesney said, look, I hear what you're saying to me. And you're saying, A, that he should move to suppress the wiretap, and B, that the government is giving you a bad deal on the guidelines calculation. Let's talk about that. And they did talk about it. And as Judge Trott pointed out, the defendant may have been satisfied 3 or 4 days later when the guilty plea came around, because Judge Chesney did actually inquire into what his complaint was.
I'm a little confused. I thought you were talking about the jurisdictional question. Are you now saying we can look at all of that to determine the jurisdictional question?
No, Your Honor.
You just sort of stopped talking about the jurisdictional question at some point.
In perhaps a ham-handed attempt to answer Judge Fletcher's question, I think bled into the...
Well, it's basically my question was jurisdictional. That they were enough alike that we could look at it.
If there is evidence at the time of the plea colloquy that counsel is not communicating and the defendant does not understand fully what he is doing in pleading guilty, then the court...
I think your position that to do that, he has to challenge the voluntariness of the waiver, of the plea agreement, which he... To even get into it. Let's say the lawyer was standing there like a potted plant, said nothing, helped nothing, did nothing. I thought your position was, if you don't challenge the voluntariness of the plea, you can't get into it at all.
That is the government's position. And the focus of this...
I would have thought that would have been your answer to Judge Fletcher's question. It doesn't matter whether he was a bronze statue, since he hasn't challenged the voluntariness of the plea. Too bad. I don't know. You can answer Judge Fletcher's question however you want, but it got me all confused as to why we're getting into... Not the bolts.
I may have misunderstood the question, Your Honor, and I may have not answered it correctly. The answer to Judge Fletcher's question is, if the defendant on appeal does not challenge the voluntariness of the plea, and this court does not find that the plea was involuntary, this court does not have jurisdiction to consider antecedent rulings.
It's the and part that worries me, because how do we get into finding whether it was voluntary or not without doing exactly what you said we can't do?
Because you focus on the plea colloquy rather than on the antecedent ruling. And whether there's a hypothetical...
But he hasn't challenged a voluntariness of a plea. How do we get into looking at that?
Well, that's the step that's missing in this case. Step one is that there must be a challenge to the voluntariness of the plea. And the and is...
And if we follow off that, it's gone.
It's gone. It's gone. It's gone. And there's no, certainly, argument supported by the record in this case that the plea colloquy, that the plea was not revealed during the colloquy to be voluntary. There was no indication. The defendant would have had to have been lying to Judge Chesney, outright lying.
Criminal defendant lying to the court?
It's shocking.
Unheard of. Why would you suggest that?
To answer Judge Chesney unequivocally yes, over and over and over again, when she asked during the plea colloquy, as she was required to do.
Well, but you know how plea colloquies go. The guy wants his plea for whatever reason, and he's going to answer yes to whatever the judge asks. That's the way it works.
Well,
you know that if you don't have to give the right questions, you're not going to get what you want.
I've been through some plea colloquies where it doesn't quite go as smoothly as that, Your Honor.
Yeah, but then what happens? Everybody so stops the show and says, wait a minute, and then the lawyer takes the client to one side and beats him up good. You better answer, and then it comes back and says, oh, no, I misunderstood the question, Your Honor. And answer, of course.
Absolutely. That's right, Your Honor, and that does happen. And that might, in the right case, raise some red flags for this court. But this case has none of that. This case, the transcript is clear, the question
is clear. The lawyer did a good job of beating up the client before. You better answer all those questions yes.
Interestingly, I think that the colloquy that's in the excerpt, the record reveals that there was very much a dialogue between Judge Chesney and the defendant that was not overly influenced by the defense lawyer. And Judge Chesney was very concerned, and the record bears this out, that the defendant knew that he was under no obligation. And in a case where there's a plea agreement, the defendant might really want the deal. Then you might see a little bit of sliding. But in a case like this, where he's pleading open, there was no sliding at all. The defendant didn't know what deal he was going to get. He didn't have to make something up in order to get what he thought was a good deal.
I read from the record that there was an offer of a deal.
There was an offer of a deal.
What was he offered?
He was offered my recollection, Your Honor, it's not in the record as to what the offer was. He was offered, I think, a low-end sentence in addition to a different calculation of the total loss.
And he didn't accept.
And he did not accept.
So you took that off the table.
And that was taken off the table, yes.
So then he had to plead pretty much straight up without any promise.
This all happened within about 2 weeks of the trial. My time is up. Let me finish your question. Within a period of 2 weeks before the trial, there was an offer. The deadline was before the pretrial conference. The pretrial conference happened, and the defendant refused to accept the offer. It was at the pretrial conference that this issue of substitution of counsel came up. There was the in-camera hearing. Trial was set to start, I think, the next Monday after the Wednesday pretrial conference. And by that time, the government was obviously hard at work, getting witnesses flown in, things like that. The offer was taken off, and then you will see in the record that the defense lawyer ran into Judge Chesney on the street outside the federal building and told her that there would be a change of plea on Monday rather than a trial, and that's how it transpired.
Counsel, I'd like you to take just a moment on the restitution. It seems that we may have to send it back for 317 on that.
I disagree, Your Honor. And the primary reason that I disagree is that there was no objection to the restitution order in the district court. And the defendant's position is, how could I object? I wasn't at the DaCosta sentencing. And there are a couple of answers to that question, a couple of observations about that. First of all, no case suggests that a co-defendant has the right to be present at another co-defendant's sentencing for the purpose of arguing about restitution. One of the cases that the defendant cites, and it's a Tenth Circuit case called Spears, S-P-E-A-R-S. Spears says, if something's going to happen at the co-defendant's sentencing that is going to impact the defendant's sentencing, the defendant has the right to be there unless the defendant has the opportunity to make the same arguments and present the same evidence at his own sentencing. In other words, the district court can't sentence another defendant, pick up whole hog the transcript, the record of that sentencing, force it on the current defendant without that defendant being able to reopen.
We're talking about DaCosta's sentencing?
Yes, Your Honor.
And when did the judge make the decision to give a lesser portion of restitution to DaCosta and a larger portion to Mr. Foreman?
The record is somewhat confusing on this. And
that's why I asked the
question. In part of it, DaCosta's sentencing preceded the defendant
right.
by several months. At that time, the probation officer calculated the restitution obligation, total restitution obligation to be $120,000. At that sentence, or at that time, Judge Chesney said, I think that this defendant is clearly the least culpable
he's
of the three. He's cooperating, and ironically, he's the one of the three that actually has some money to contribute
yeah.
on a regular basis.
He'll be paying and the others won't.
Exactly. So Judge Chesney says, I'm going to give him a third of it. I'm going to reduce it by the $26,000 that he's already repaid, so he has $14,000. We fast forward several months.
Does she say anything about it? I'm going to sock at the foreman?
No. She does say there are three defendants.
Right.
I'm going to divide it by three and make the cost to pay $40,000. But she doesn't talk about specifically what she's going to order either Foreman or Okanubi, the third defendant, to pay. We then go forward to the Foreman case. There is more talk about restitution, and there's an evidentiary hearing. At that point in time, the actual number of checks are calculated. It comes out to be $112,000. Judge Chesney decides, applying a clear and convincing evidence standard to the loss calculation, to hold Foreman responsible only for the six checks that he personally admitted, which came out to be $90,000. Then she credits Foreman the $28,000 that DaCosta had already paid. She reduces it by what the victims had already been paid back, giving him credit that he didn't ask for. There's no objection. Everybody's on their way out. And the clerk does make an offhand comment saying, well, should this be joint several or not? Judge Chesney sort of says, look, the defendant's not represented, we can't really talk
about
it.
Yeah, it got really confusing then because she had relieved Beckworth as his
Becker,
lawyer. So
yeah.
He's standing there right now unrepresented.
Sure, but the essential point with regard to that is, at that point there's only two choices. Should the unobjected to $72,000 be solely paid by Foreman, or should it be jointly and severally shared by the two other defendants? Nobody would say, no lawyer, if you sent this back, it would go back, we'd stand up in front of Judge Chesney, Judge Chesney would say to the lawyer, would you prefer that Mr. Foreman pay the entire $72,000 or that the payments that DaCosta is continuing to make are credited against it?
Can I ask a question that really doesn't have much to do with anything? You're never going to see a cent from Foreman, are you?
No.
Then why were you fighting over restitution from Foreman?
We were not fighting over it, Your Honor. It happened at Judge Chesney realized that she had to under the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act.
So the law required her to do it even though he was going to be spending the rest of for all time in other prisons, including the federal prison, and he has no money at all?
That's correct.
So this is really just a sort of hypothetical thing.
It's a license plate.
Yes, I mean, Mr. Foreman is he's illegally in the country, and what's going to happen to him is he will be transferred when he leaves BOP custody to the INS and deported to Jamaica.
So if we send this back for a further restitution hearing, are you just going to give up and say, get him out of here?
It depends on what the court's order is. We'll follow the court's order if the court sends it back.
Because, you know, there's an unreality to this whole fight over restitution.
There is an unreality, I agree, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Case is arguable, stand submitted. We'll next hear.